You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tensions are running high between the Whitmer administration and legislative leaders. Tim Alberta is a senior political correspondent for the website Politico. And as the COVID-19 crisis was ramping up, he was working on a profile of Gretchen Whitmer. And he joins us now to talk further about the ripple effects. Tim Alberta, welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to be back with you.
You know, we called you up, among other things, to ask about the protests in Lansing that have been asking, among other things, for a speedier reopening of business in certain sectors of Michigan's economy. How long did that truce between Governor Whitmer and the Republican legislative leaders last? Was it 1 week, maybe two?
Not real long. You know, what's so interesting, April, is early in the month of April, I had been setting out on a pretty comprehensive reporting project to profile Governor Whitmer. And I was really struck talking with not just former Republicans who served at high levels that she had worked closely alongside, but with current Republican leaders, including the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. And in all of these conversations with folks in writing this pretty lengthy magazine profile of the governor, you could not find one person who had anything really negative to say. And that was including her early handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. There was just a real sense that Republican leaders in the State House were on the same page with her, that they had her back, that this was not going to descend into partisan bickering. And of course, as the laws of journalism would have it, the day I published that magazine profile was the same day that she announced the expanded nature of the emergency stay-at-home order. And that expanded version of it is really when the dam burst. It included, of course, a ban on traveling between residences. It banned landscaping work being done, among other things, and of course, prohibited certain items from being purchased at stores. This wasn't sort of a steady upward trajectory in tension between parties in Lansing. It was basically a flat line that spiked suddenly. And when it spiked, it spiked in a big way. You had leaders coming out, lawmakers on the Republican side breaking very vocally with the governor, and you had members of the congressional delegation rebuking her, which had not been the case up until that point. You obviously had these big protests in Lansing. So suddenly it went from zero to 60 virtually overnight. Now things seem to be receding ever so slightly, I think in part because the governor has scaled back some of those guidelines, but also because I think there is a recognition that the end is near to some degree as far as this sort of sweeping nature of the stay-at-home order and the shutdown of many of these businesses.
Do you see anything different between the groundswell of conservative energy that built up over those weeks versus the energy that propelled President Trump to office 4 years ago?
Boy, that's a good question. I certainly think there's a great deal of overlap. I should say
there's been some overlaps in funding. You know, there have been several reports documenting, you know, who was behind some, if not all, of the funding and energy at the state Capitol protests over the past month.
That's absolutely right. I mean, look, whenever you have the opportunity for mass mobilization and mass protests, there are going to be groups that see an opportunity for investment there and really take advantage of it and take what might be sort of a small organic thing and turn it into something that's sort of more manifestly put on or manufactured. And I think that's what was happening in Lansing. I don't doubt for a second that you had some number, maybe not an insignificant number, of citizens from various places who heard about this or read about it on Facebook and who were genuinely worked up and they wanted to come out and beat their horns and show they were unhappy with Gretchen Whitmer, with the government writ large. But yeah, I mean, we know from reporting that's been done, from just sort of tracing the cord back through social media and seeing some of the groups that were doing this organizing and who's funding them, we know that these were partisan organizations who were looking to make this into a partisan thing. And what's interesting about it, April, in my view, is that there's always going to be an opportunity, especially in an election year, to try and score points around something like this. And it shouldn't surprise us that, you know, conservative organizations were going to try and beat up on Gretchen Whitmer right around the time when she's being considered for Joe Biden's running mate, and also Michigan, obviously one of the three or four most important states this fall. But I think what's interesting about it is it's not really all that partisan of a thing. You had protesters in Indiana marching on the state house, which is run by Republicans. And, you know, just in talking with friends, families, neighbors, looking at your crazy Facebook feed, you do sense that there's a lot of people across party lines who feel this anger, this irritation, you know, a real sense of fear and foreboding about what this has in store for them and their family and their businesses. But obviously, you do have some opportunistic actors, and in some cases, just some bad actors who are going to try and exploit it.
What do we know about the groups that were organizing online and providing some funding for the statehouse groups? I know the Michigan Freedom Foundation was a big part of the organizing in Michigan. What do we know about their history?
You know, stop me if you've heard this before, but a lot of this winds its way back to the DeVos family, and that's not terribly surprising. You know, the DeVos family has been heavily involved with a lot of philanthropic work over the years, of course, and we also know about their business ties. But the DeVos family also is easily one of the five or six most influential families in Republican politics over the last, you know, decade or so. They have been involved with everything from state legislative races, ballot initiatives, congressional races, obviously being involved at the presidential level. We know that in no small part, Betsy DeVos wound up as Secretary of Education because of her ties to Mike Pence, who was able to persuade Donald Trump to put her in the cabinet. I digress. The point being that the DeVos family and their allies, political allies, have always sort of had their hands in everything. Some of the operatives who are closely affiliated with them, among others, Greg McNeely, they are at the helm of some of these organizations that were instrumental in doing this organizing. What's really interesting is that you've actually seen a number of these essentially sister organizations, sister chapters, pop up in the span of about 72 hours online. So you saw Michiganders Against Excessive Quarantine on Facebook. You saw a similar group in Ohio, a similar group in Pennsylvania. And it doesn't take a whole lot of sleuthing to, as I said, sort of trace the cord back and figure out where the power and where the money is coming from. And so in a state like Michigan, especially where you've seen some of these big fights on ballot initiatives and where you've seen some of these fights over everything from charter schools to right to work, it took about 30 seconds to look at those protests and to check out your Facebook feed and to read a few of the familiar names and to realize where this was coming from.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. He has a recent article profiling Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. We're talking with him about election year politics involving Whitmer and many others. Tim, Donald Trump pretty famously tapped into a silent majority, voters who were embarrassed to say that they supported Trump, but who nonetheless voted for him in 2016. Do you think he still lays claim to that territory?
It feels more and more like the silent majority is now a very outspoken minority. One of the phenomena of the Trump political era, I think, April, is to sort of study the Trump voter who will tell you that they have soured on him in some way, that they wish he would stop tweeting, that some of what he says and does kind of drives them crazy, and yet they are 100% committed to his quest for reelection. And then they will talk to you openly about why. Oftentimes it has every bit as much to do with what the Democrats are doing as with what the administration is doing. I raise that point because many of these people would have fit the bill of part of that silent majority 4 years ago. They might have felt socially uncomfortable copping to the fact that they were supporting Donald Trump. And now they're quite open about it. And in some part, it almost feels like it's been jarred loose from them, this sort of ongoing culture war and the constant, what many of them will view as the sort of partisan media complex attacking Donald Trump from the left, that it has emboldened them in some way to come to his defense, even while there's some dissonance here, because they will themselves sort of acknowledge that, yeah, that's totally inappropriate what he just said, or gosh, I wish he wouldn't have tweeted this thing. And so I don't know that it's fair to even call it a silent majority anymore. I don't feel like all that many people are still silent. I think the battle lines have been drawn in a pretty visible way at this point. The question is still going to be, come November, can Donald Trump simultaneously turn out all of these people who voted for him in 2016 while doing enough to sort of depress enthusiasm and energy on the Democratic side? Because that's been his MO since day one. It's not just about promoting his own candidacy. It's about taking the air out of the other candidates. A big part of Donald Trump's political success to date has been to sort of win by process of disqualifying his opponent.
I noticed that on Twitter recently, you noted some polling about Trump losing ground with older voters. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a huge problem if it lasts, and there's just not enough evidence right now to even suggest that it could. What we had seen, though, in a period of a couple of weeks, to step back and contextualize this a little bit, basically, every good pollster right now is attempting to measure this question among voters of, is your biggest concern about public health, or is your biggest concern about economics? Obviously, for many people, that they aren't mutually exclusive. It's a matter of prioritizing. And so what you've seen in polling over the last few weeks is that a pretty healthy majority of the country had been prioritizing public health over the economy, but that gap has been winnowing pretty consistently over the last 3 weeks or so. What's interesting is that the one group that has been a holdout from day one, and that the numbers really aren't moving much with, is among older voters, 65 plus, for obvious reasons. They are the people who are the most likely to die if they are infected by the coronavirus.
Not to mention slightly removed from the workforce.
That's exactly right. Yes, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, of course, yeah, that many of them are retired, right? So they don't have to worry about losing their job. And so when you put those things together, you can understand why they would be predisposed to prioritize the public health concern. What we saw as a corollary from that, and we haven't seen it sustained, but it'll be interesting to study over the next couple of months, is, you know, Donald Trump has lost ground among those voters, because clearly some of them believe that he does not prioritize public health as much as he prioritizes economic health. Whether or not that sort of provides an opening for Joe Biden, it remains to be seen whether he can exploit it, whether he can capitalize on it. But when you look at how the margins broke down in 2016, you know, Donald Trump only won seniors in Michigan by 4 points. In Wisconsin, he won them by only 1 point. So there's not a whole lot of margin for error. And we know one thing about seniors, it's that they vote. 65 plus is a very reliable voting demographic. So it's not one that Donald Trump can afford to lose any ground with.
Tim, to your point about the extent to which the Trump campaign will want to try to depress the turnout for Joe Biden, nobody has to tell election watchers in Michigan that African-American voters are important to this presidential contest. The chestnut is no turnout. You don't get a win in Michigan. Considering the fact that the COVID virus has been so deadly and so devastating in African-American communities, do you think the Democratic Party is any closer to closing a sale with voters who, you know, maybe turned out for Barack Obama and maybe had second thoughts about Hillary Clinton and who are now seeing their communities devastated?
Yeah, it's such an important question. There is reason for some cautious optimism if you're a Democrat, because Joe Biden has a relationship by proxy with Barack Obama, with the Black community, that Hillary Clinton just did not. And you will see organically more enthusiasm for a Joe Biden and more of a sense of trust and sort of intimacy, as much intimacy as a random rank-and-file voter can have with a presidential candidate. People feel that with Joe Biden in a way that they simply did not feel it with Hillary Clinton. So to that degree, yes, I would say that Biden starts in a better position than did Hillary Clinton. At the same time, there is a ton of work to be done, specifically not just work in terms of getting on the ground and shaking hands and doing the field operating work to get out the vote. There is work to be done to ensure that some of these neighborhoods, some of these communities that have been devastated by COVID-19, as you said, that they have sufficient access to voting precincts where they feel that they are safe and where they can go there and vote and not have to worry about their public health. And, you know, that is something that we haven't even really begun to grapple with, really. Every 4 years, presidential campaigns have to deal with a whole new set of circumstances, but generally they all fall within the same sort of general orbit. This is something totally new. And I can tell you from talking with Democrats over the last few weeks, it's something they're immensely concerned about, because if you don't have high turnout in some of these really densely packed urban centers that are heavily minority precincts, you're not going to win. And these are the areas that we've seen hit the hardest so far by the virus. And if it comes back with a vengeance this fall, as many health professionals are expecting, then that presents sort of a perfect storm to see depressed turnout on the Democratic side.
Let's turn things back to the state scene for just one more moment. In your profile of Governor Whitmer, we really got the sense as readers that she's someone who isn't deterred by bullies, but on the contrary, can let her haters be motivators. But that was before the protests at the state capitol. Do you see Gretchen Whitmer possibly being able to message her way through the turn of events with coronavirus?
She's trying. You know, it's interesting that the emergency stay-at-home order was scheduled to expire on May 1st. And it's interesting that last week, in advance of that expiration, she came out and decided to scale things back. She's not going to get up to the podium and wave a white flag, but in some ways, that's what it was. It was very clear that she was going to have to do something to scale back this order, not just because of the protest, but because people around her who have her own best interests at heart were making it known to her that, look, this just, it overreached a little bit. Look, politicians make mistakes every day. Elected officials are not infallible, far from it. They make mistakes all the time, both in policy and in politics. The best thing you can do is rectify it really quickly. And from my vantage point, having been in and around her orbit for the better part of a month now, really closely sort of monitoring what's been happening, it was apparent almost immediately that she had overreached a little bit with that expansion of the order. If she had acted a little more quickly to rectify it, then you probably wouldn't have seen 4,000 people show up in Lansing. And then once they did show up, if she had retracted it immediately, then that would have looked very cut and dried, like she was doing so in response that she had been bullied or she had been cowed by those protests. So she sort of boxed herself in a little bit there. And now the question is going to be, as we move forward and as the partisanship sort of ratchets up here, I mean, her numbers are still in pretty good shape, but clearly she is a far more polarizing figure today than she was 3 or 3.5 weeks ago. As Republicans in the state house have become sort of emboldened to go after her, and as the Trump White House goes after her, how does she respond? Does she sort of go into an attack position, or does she sort of let it roll off her back as she is sort of known to do and kind of play it cool and not show that she is frustrated by this? Because she's in a really tricky spot all the while, of course, auditioning for this role of Vice President of the United States with all eyes on her right now.
Tim Alberta is chief political correspondent for Politico. We'll include a link to his profile of Gretchen Whitmer at our website. Tim, crazy times. We have sympathy for a political reporter who can't actually be out on the campaign trail right now. So best of luck, and we're looking forward to more stuff you're filing this year.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you guys having me on. Hope everybody is doing okay in your households and everybody's keeping their sanity in these insane times.